Welcome to episode 39 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Stephanie Roy, a partner in our telecom, internet, and media group, by Mark Frey, who is former chief of staff at the Office of Policy Development at the Department of Homeland Security and now a senior director at Steptoe's D.C. office. Our guest commentator today is Tom Finan, senior cybersecurity strategist and counsel at DHS's National Protection and Programs Directorate, NPPD, where he's currently working on policy issues related to cybersecurity insurance and cybersecurity legislation. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS and the record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's get started. This week in NSA is pretty straightforward barely newsworthy. The House and Senate Judiciary Chairs got together and called for action on the USA Freedom Act. Sound you heard when they did was crickets chirping. No one was particularly interested in signing up for doing that before the elections. My guess is no one's going to be all that interested in doing it in the lame duck, especially if, as now looks likely, the Republicans actually take the Senate, but also because some of the people who are most dubious about the USA Freedom Act are leaving and probably won't want to push a compromise they don't much like through as their last act in the Senate. So I'm guessing not much happens until the spring of next year. That's the main news in the NSA. We'll have a chance to talk to Bob Litt in a couple of weeks, and he can give us what I suspect will be a slightly more hopeful view of what might happen in the lame duck. But what did happen, almost as remarkable as the passage of the USA Freedom Act, is the breakup of the ICE flows over how you buy ordinary popular entertainment on cable. Suddenly everybody is unbundling and starting to offer a la carte and streaming services. This is a big deal for consumers, but it might also be a big deal for the way we look at net neutrality. I thought, Stephanie, maybe you could tell us exactly what's happening and what you think it really means.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. Two major programmers last week announced their own streaming services, HBO, presumably their library of content and original programming, and CBS, and with CBS with respect to their own programs, including current season programs, and archives of certain series that they've produced in the past. And it's significant in, for a couple of respects. First, it shows the increasing competitiveness of the online field. People see the success of outfits like Netflix and Amazon Prime and want to get in the game. There, people like HBO and CBS are also looking to recoup more of those dollars that they see consumers spending on online streaming services, cutting out the middlemen like Netflix, Amazon, and even their cable providers to some extent. I presume it's a pretty complicated ballet that they're dancing in terms of assuaging the concerns of the people who are still their primary distributors of their programmings and also looking to recoup more directly the consumer dollar. HBO has said that their services are going to be at around, I think, $14.99 a month, which is thereabouts what the cable company charges a subscriber for an HBO on a monthly basis. And I think CBS has talked about a price point of $5.99 a month, which is a significant uptick from what I think they are getting on a per-subscriber basis to be retransmitted, for example, on cable systems and satellite television platforms. There was a lot of speculation when the announcements were first made about what does this mean for net neutrality? Are we adding two powerful programming voices in favor of net neutrality? And I think the first instincts would be to say yes, because neither one of these operators have their own pipes. They're not an entity like NBC Universal, who's connected to Comcast, who's proposed to kind of control access to almost half the high bandwidth pipes into the United States consumer households. But they are reliant on access to those eyeballs through third-party networks. But a very interesting development. Last week, HBO came on the record as saying that they see the market for internet access services to consumers as a two-sided market, and that somebody needs to be able to be paying more than just the consumer for the maintenance of this network. So the market's taking that as an indication that HBO is willing to pay to play to get premium access to those eyeballs. Which is in part not surprising because HBO has a history of being a premium service, and I think they want to maintain that status. And they also seem to have the the coffers available to kind of fund that type of access, and looking to use the weight of those coffers to back up their access to the U.S. household. But at the same time, I think there is some upside. I don't think you'll see filings by CBS or HBO on net neutrality right away, you know, or even at any time in the near future with the FCC. But I think it changes the flavor of the landscape a little bit at the agency as they consider their million-plus, closing on 2 million-plus, I think, filings in their net neutrality proceeding right now. And I think they're just the start. I think we're going to see more announcements from more programming outfits about, like, a la carte streaming services, which, by the way, is not looking too cheap when you start adding up these numbers.
Yeah, I suppose if you wanted everything, but the real answer is that most of those channels people don't really want. They pay for them because they're bundled. So we'll start seeing the each channel will be on its own bottom, and some of them may fail.
That may be true. I don't think I don't think the aggregators are going away anytime soon. But I think it's an evolution. I think they'll find certain programming is only survivable when it's offered, in connection with others. That's not an attraction in and of its own right. But they've always said many things will be the death of video. And it hasn't. We've just increased our total video consumption as a nation on a hourly and weekly and monthly basis even.
Well, does this mean though that the pipe people are sliding into being, what they've always feared, which is dumb pipe providers, whether they like it or not, maybe better paid dumb pipe providers, but as more and more stuff becomes available a la carte, it gets harder and harder for the guy who provides the wire to make money off providing that.
It's not so hard to make money if you're not that regulated in how you make that pipe available, though, Stuart. I think that's why Verizon and others are fighting so hard on the net neutrality front. I think their margins right now on the pipe are huge. For each marginal new subscriber, their margins are the stuff of legend. It depends a lot on how the space is regulated, which is why net neutrality is such a hot topic.
Huh. Well, it is. There's no going back for sure. This is like discovering MP3s. No one's going back to buy albums or CDs. And I think it probably reflects the economic forces that have governed are increasingly going to take over this net neutrality debate as people begin to bring them money rather than just FCC filings to bear on this. It's going to be fun to watch, I think, although as they say If you're not sure what the product is that you're consuming, it may be that you're the product that's being consumed, and those of us who have who are on the other end of the pipe may turn out to be the products that are being sold to the suppliers of content.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we can always use another good lawyer in the fight, Stuart. If you
I'm sure. Well, I'm still struggling with the question of whether I'm responsible for my teenage daughter's activities online. The Georgia appellate courts have, there was a Dickens a novel in which I think Mr. Dombey is told that the law presumes that he's responsible for the acts of his wife, and he says, if the law presumes that, the law is an ass. I think you could say much the same thing about the presumption that we're responsible for the acts of our adolescent kids, but maybe the decision was a little more nuanced than that. Michael, I know you looked at that one.
Yeah, I think the decision is more defensible than that because of the particular facts here. This is a case in which a young teenage boy and a friend created a fake Facebook account in the name of another classmate and had that account post all sorts of offensive and sexually explicit content and, changed around a photograph of her to make her look really ridiculous. And the girl and her parents sued the boy and his parents for intentional infliction of emotional distress and defamation, and the parents also for breach of a state law, a common law duty to supervise their son's use of the computer. And the Court of Appeals said that the parents were not entitled to summary judgment because there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether they did breach that duty. And what the court said was not that they had a duty to supervise their son's internet activity in general, but that even after they found out about what he had done, they didn't do anything about it. They didn't even bother to look at the site to see what he had done. They didn't make him take the site down. They didn't try to figure out whom he had defamed or harmed. They pretty much did nothing, at least in the court's view. And it was that inaction after they were alerted to his conduct that the court said could have breached the duty to supervise the kid's conduct. So it did seem pretty irresponsible, at least according to the court's account.
You know, I hear you on that, but the fact is, you know, the school found out, the school disciplined the kids who were responsible for it, the parents then disciplined them for it. I'm not sure that your first reaction is, I want to see it. You want to make sure that your kid has paid the price for breaking a school rule. I'm not sure that it was obvious to the parents that there was something still up at that point. And if I'm reading the story right, it looks as though the school refused to tell the victim's parents who the perpetrators were. So they had no way to actually say, by the way, this is still up and it's still causing pain. It was like a year, and then they filed a lawsuit, and then the page came down almost immediately. I'm not sure that frankly, it seems to me that the school has got some responsibility here.
No, I don't agree. The girl who was defamed knew who it was. That's how the school found out about it. Her parents knew who was responsible, and they could have called the defendant's parents. And it wasn't until Facebook itself decided to take it down once it found out that this was a fake account. The parents apparently did nothing. Yeah, they grounded the kid for a week. They wouldn't let him see his friends for a week. But they knew the site was there, and yet, according to the evidence, they did nothing about it. I mean, I would think they would at least tell the kid, take that thing down right away, and they didn't even do that.
Yeah, I'm less sure of that, and it is pretty clear that the parents of the victim didn't know who the perpetrators were. because the school said that they had a confidentiality obligation not to disclose that.
Yeah, but their daughter knew. That's how she went to the school, and that's how she got the school.
Ah, so let me ask this. They sat there for a year and never called the parents of the perpetrator to say, hey, you know, it's still up. They just bided their time and then filed a lawsuit. I mean, there's something funny here.
There's nothing in the opinion about whether or not the parents of the victim called. But whether they did or not, the defendant's parents and the parents were defendants themselves, they knew what had happened. Because they knew their son was disciplined for a site, a fake site that he created, or a fake account that he created. And yet, according to the court, they did absolutely nothing other than ground their son. They did nothing to take the site down.
Alright, well, I'm gonna pull rank on you now. I have gone through 3 adolescences, and you have gone through 0 with your children. We'll have this discussion again in 10 years. All right. And speaking of issues we get to have, discussions we get to have every 10 years or so, the FBI director has come out and given a pretty impassioned speech on going dark. And now this has been a topic that's been raised by the FBI many times over the years, but Jim Comey, who's only been on the job about a year, and who came in kind of as Snowden disclosures were ramping up the antibodies to government surveillance, hasn't said much, but now he's come out swinging for essentially an expansion of CALEA, which applies to standard phone systems, applies to cellular phone systems, it applies to VoIP, but it hasn't covered a lot of the messaging and Snapchatting and other mechanisms, the apps that allow you to have conversations over the internet. And he's basically saying we go to these companies, most of the time they want to help, but they never designed any capability to do an intercept into the system, and it takes them months and a lot of money to retrofit something on, and maybe by then the crime can't be discovered or prosecuted. I have to say, I think he's selling into a bad climate, but I think he's decided that he's just going to have to try to change the climate by raising this publicly.
Yeah, I think you're right. The interesting thing is what gave rise to the speech, I think, was all the news about Apple and Google making encryption a default on their smartphones. And he did address that, but all he really could say about that was, we need to have a national discussion about whether that makes sense. He didn't propose legislation because he clearly knows there's absolutely zero chance Congress would ever restrict device makers or software makers' ability to put encryption on devices. But he did call for an expansion of CALEA to other services beyond telecoms and broadband providers. And that's a proposal that the FBI does roll out every few years. But it hasn't ever pushed it hard, you know, since really it first proposed CALEA. And so it'll be interesting to see if they do push it hard in the next Congress. But I think you're right. This is a very, very tough market in which to sell that sort of a proposal. Just, you know, privacy is paramount right now, and it will be in the near future, you know, until there's something that swings the pendulum back the other way.
Yeah, well, of course, now that you've expressed skepticism, it sounds like they're coming for you. I noticed that he said, kind of, you might have missed it if you weren't listening for it, but at one point he said, my personal view about this, which I think is code for, I still don't have the administration's permission to advocate for these things. I don't have their permission to propose legislation, but they can't stop me from giving this speech. And so we're not going to see legislation in the Obama administration, I'm pretty confident, because by now all the battle lines are drawn, and there are plenty of people who do not want this piece of legislation proposed. And frankly, it probably wouldn't make the legislation more likely to pass if it did come out of the administration. So my guess is that he's going to be giving speeches for 2 or 3 years, and waiting for some, you know, he gave a, you know, chilling stories about, men who pretended to be, 13-year-old girls and persuaded boys to, come out and, get in a waiting cab, and the cab driver was really the guy who'd been corresponding with the kid, and then he kills the kid, and he, wipes his phone and the kid's phone, all of that by way of saying, you see, there's really valuable evidence that could catch really bad people on these phones. I think we're going to hear a lot of stories like that for the next few years.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think your analysis of it is right, too. I really doubt the administration would push this, especially in the last 2 years. It's just not something that's high on the agenda.
Since nobody seems to be eager to pass USA Freedom, maybe we could get to the FBI director and the chairs of the judiciary committees together. They could do a comprehensive legislation that solves both, addresses both problems. No one would like it, but it may be the only way that any of this legislation is going to pass anytime soon.
Yeah, and since the Justice Department is using search warrants to get any sort of content now anyway, even though if they're going farther than ECPA requires, they wouldn't be giving up all that much by going along with at least parts of those acts or those bills.
So even though the Justice Department has been reluctant to actually come out swinging for new regulatory authority over this kind of technology for this purpose, it does seem to be taking a pretty aggressive stand after 6 years of relative inaction on how to approach disability claims that websites are inaccessible to people with one disability or another. Did you look at that?
It's interesting. The application of the ADA to websites is an issue that split the courts. There are several circuits that say the ADA doesn't apply to websites. It only applies to brick-and-mortar commercial establishments. Other courts have said it does apply to websites, and so the Justice Department in this recent case involving H&R Block made it pretty clear that it believes the Act applies to websites, and even though there aren't any regulations about what sorts of thing the ADA requires for websites, in the settlement of this suit, it seems to indicate that the Justice Department believes that you need to have things like captions so that people who are deaf can read the content of what's in the audio, and other things for the blind, and things other than using a mouse to allow somebody who is physically challenged to navigate the web. And so it's a pretty broad application of the Act. And so I think people are reading this as a sign of regulations that might eventually come out that would be broadly applicable to commercial websites.
Oh, and there's another possibility for the FBI. They can say, we're not going dark, we're going blind, and we need access too. Maybe that would get the litigators more enthusiastic about presenting their claim against tech companies.
I'm not going to touch that.
All right. So speaking of controversy, the right to be forgotten is actually generating some controversy. The good news, there is good news. The BBC is starting to get a little unhappy about having its articles pulled out of Google, and Auntie Beeb, as they call her in the UK, has decided to put together a Right to Remember page where they will assemble links to all the stories that have been pulled down by Google, which I thought was a nice a passive-aggressive approach to the EU decision. And I particularly like the image of Auntie Beeb dueling, at knife point with nanny EU regulators. That's the good news. There's a little bit of resistance in Europe. The bad news is there's an organization, I think, Consumer Watchdog, which I don't know whether it's a real organization or whether it's just a kind of AstroTurf group, but they're most famous for trashing Google on every conceivable ground, especially privacy. They've asked Google to adopt the right to be forgotten as a voluntary matter inside the United States so that we can bring European standards of censorship to the web here in the United States. I don't think they're going to get too much traction, but they claim that polls show that Americans actually support the idea. Obviously, it could never be adopted as a matter of law here, but I guess it's not inconceivable that Google could decide to do this. In fact, they'd be First Amendment protected if they decided to set up a little tribunal to decide which things we should forget.
Yeah, it does seem that the BBC and the Times and other media are really causing at least some people in Europe to reconsider whether this makes any sense at all, though it's hard to imagine regulators over there going back on this, but I think there's gonna be some reconsideration of some sort. Maybe when they come out with a new data protection regulation, they'll actually back off in some fashion, because they've got to understand now better than they did when this decision was issued by the ECJ. They've got to understand how cockamamie this is now in practical implementation.
Well, maybe I fear that the more we call it cockamamie, the more they like it. Probably the better approach, if you want the Europeans to think twice about it, is to say, so you are handing over the power of censorship to Google, and since they all hate Google, the question is, do you think you're punishing Google by making them take this stuff down, or are you rewarding Google by handing them the powers of the state to shape the content that everyone in the European Union actually gets to see? So one other case that I wanted to cover, maybe there's a couple, but this TD Bank case, they paid $850,000 to the state attorneys general for lost data, a compromise of account data. Am I right that this sounds like they lost a tape and the data had a bunch of account information and it wasn't encrypted? And they paid $850,000 without there being any evidence that anybody's account had actually been compromised. Am I right to read it that way?
I believe that's right. It always surprises me when I read about one of these cases where a company is still using physical backup tapes and having them shipped, on a truck to some.
That'll never die. All these, spinning discs are still cheaper than solid state memory, and tape is still cheaper than spinning discs. So all of these forms of storage will continue. But it is, this is just backup, and you just ship it off to, some coal mine in Pennsylvania to store, right?
Well, you can just, I always have this image of a round disc bouncing off the back of an Iron Mountain truck and, unspooling as it bounces.
It goes into a pothole and falls off the back and gets run over by a truck right behind it, and the attorneys general are $850,000 richer.
Yeah, and you know, in this case, it's TD Bank. It offered to transfer the customer's funds to a new account, give credit for any losses that might be reported, gave a free year of credit monitoring. But 9 state AGs investigated anyway and extracted a settlement for $850,000, which is all going into the coffers of the state AGs, not going into refunds
to
victims.
I always think of the state AGs as sort of imitating the business model of the FTC, but without the any of the nuance, right? It's just we can interpret this so you're in the wrong, give us money. And that certainly sounds like what they did in this case. Yes, you should be more careful with your backup tapes, but the in a world where the Iranians are getting into a bunch of large banks and actually seeing data, or at least the Russians are. I don't know the Iranians are doing that, but we have lots of actual intrusions where actual compromises are going on, and to have people spending their money for security on encrypting backup tapes that probably nobody could read after they fell off the truck strikes me as a misuse of resources and a misuse of regulatory authority.
It would be interesting to have one of these AGs be a little creative and go after a Russian oligarch who is the owner or officer of some outfit that's benefiting from these intrusions, rather than going after a bank that itself was victimized.
Right. As I said, it's the FTC's business model, but without the nuance. You need to find somebody who's already on their back foot, who's already reeling from bad publicity, and who can't easily defend themselves. And then you get a quick settlement. If they actually went after the actual intruders, it would be a long and difficult haul and not a quick kill, and so I'm guessing that they never will. Speaking of all those intruders, I am struck by the fact that the last week or so has seen the Russians get caught breaking into systems going after Western governments in Ukraine using Microsoft Zero Days. Used to be the Russians never got caught. They're either getting sloppier or they're taking a leaf out of the Chinese book and saying, well, getting caught doesn't matter. Why don't we just keep doing this? Even if we do get caught, nobody's going to stop us. But I thought it was interesting that we're now starting to actually identify Russian intrusions. The FBI says there's somebody more sophisticated than Unit 31986 who in the Chinese government who's been breaking into a whole bunch of targeted attacks, also at governments, but mainly at companies. I think the private company that talked about this called the group Axiom. But the one that really struck terror in my heart was the indication that there's a new way of tailoring these attacks. The usual way is you send spearfish emails that look like something that you should be getting, and they're very carefully socially engineered to get you to click on the attachment. And that's getting harder to pull off as people start putting detonation chambers in their systems to test every attachment that before it gets opened on a desktop. And then they've been doing these drive-by watering hole where they go to the Council on Foreign Relations website and just infect everybody on the theory that these are the people who actually run the country. Although since I'm on a member of that, I can tell you that's these are people who maybe once thought about running the country, but nonetheless, it's fooled the Chinese and the Russians, and they are compromising everybody there. But this latest approach is to say, why don't we buy an ad, and you can apparently now buy ads that say, you tell your, the people you're buying the ads from, I only want this ad to be shown to a particular IP address or a range of IP addresses or to people who come from a particular domain or company. So you could say, I want to show this ad only to Steptoe.com visitors, and then when the ad shows up, if somebody clicks on that, it takes them to a site that automatically infects their computer. So highly targeted and dirt cheap. You know, it's like 50 cents an ad. You can easily imagine writing an ad that would get a Steptoe lawyer to check it, to click on that. You know, you would click on something that, if you saw an ad on the web that said Michael Vadas arrest records, right, you'd want to know what that was. Be irresistible for people. And that seems to be the latest way in which they're getting folks to take that first infected bite, and after that, once they've got a little bit of traction with the network, they can infect the rest. So I thought that was pretty scary from the point of view of protecting yourself out on the net.
Yeah, that is pretty scary to have such a personalized, even more personalized than spear phishing in a way. About the report that I said about Russian hackers, I wonder whether the Russians almost wanted to be noticed now because they may want the West to realize, hey, we've got some things we can do to you if you keep up with these sanctions over Ukraine. We could make you hurt a little bit too.
Yeah, I think actually that makes a lot of sense. They saw, frankly, what the Iranians did, which was just to twist our tail by DDoSing our banks on a very predictable and not too damaging schedule, which left the impression they could do a lot worse if relations between the U.S. and Iran got worse, i.e., if we bombed their nuclear facilities, having seen that worked for the Iranians, I mean, there's no Western intimidation tactic that Putin wants to be beaten on. He wants to adopt them all. My guess is he did say, look, sometimes there's an advantage to getting caught. Why don't you guys do something a little less subtle than you've been doing in the past?
Yeah, because as you say, my perception has always been that Russia has been more sophisticated, or at least more concerned with being quiet about its computer intrusions than China. So this is a little unusual to have them found out like this. It certainly has happened in the past,
yeah,
but it's less frequent than with China.
I used to say that the Russians and the Americans and the Israelis and some of the Europeans, when they got together and talked about the Chinese, were like cat burglars who were talking about people who do smash and grabs with a 54 Chevy through the front window. What really galled them was that the guys who were going through the front window were making more money than they were. Then Jim Comey came out and described the Chinese as being like drunken burglars. So apparently I'm right. That is exactly what they talk about when they get together, is I can't believe these guys are so unsubtle, and I can't believe they're doing so well being so unsubtle.
Yeah, because they keep getting away with it.
Last topic I wanted to ask you about, just because it looks like a privacy law that is turning out not to be as stupid as it could be, the Video Privacy Act. Did you follow that and come up with an approach to video privacy?
Yeah, you could say it's not as stupid, or you could say it's not as effective as it might be. This was a claim brought against the Cartoon Network, saying that it violated the Video Privacy Protection Act by disclosing people's video viewing records when they viewed videos through mobile apps. When the Cartoon Network would disclose people's viewing history along with their device ID number, and it would, what Cartoon Network was allegedly doing was disclosing this information to a data analytics company called Bango. And according to the complaint, Bango could reverse engineer the device ID to actually identify the individual. But the court found that there was not a violation of the act here because the device ID number itself was not personally identifiable information within the meaning of the act. So even if the data analytics company could take that information and combine it with other information to identify the individual, since the ID number itself didn't identify the individual, there was no violation of the act.
I find that a little surprising. I would have thought it'd be pretty easy to tell who that person was, the courts are being, willfully ignoring the fact that you can do that, perhaps because they think the consequences would be too extreme, which is probably true, but that hasn't stopped other courts from adopting sweeping privacy interpretations.
You might think that they'd be more inclined towards an expansive interpretation of this act, since this is really the Bob Bork Protection Act, since it was passed when Judge Bork's blockbuster rental history was disclosed during his confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I was surprised, but I think on the whole, it's a good thing. I mean, the Video Privacy Protection Act is almost certainly going to produce mostly unintended consequences, having a decision that says we're not going to overread the act is probably going to be better in terms of avoiding unusual consequences than anything else that we could see out of the courts.
The other interesting thing is that the courts have interpreted the act broadly in the sense that they've held that it applies to internet video providers, even though the act talks about videotape service providers. You know, it was written before there wasn't any such thing as Netflix or Hulu. So they've interpreted its scope broadly. But here now, you know, maybe this is, as you're suggesting, sort of a retrenchment in that now they're defining the scope of personal information more narrowly.
Yeah, maybe so. And we've seen that a little in some other cases where the courts, after taking a very broad view of some of the remedies for wiretap and the like against Google, began to think, well, gee, maybe we don't want to impose $1 trillion in liability on Google just for running their the Google Earth car or Earth View car around neighborhoods and collecting a bit of Wi-Fi. Maybe there is a sort of modest retrenching going on. All right. We've got to finish up here, and let's take a break. I know that Mark Frey and Tom Finan are going to do an interview. Why don't we hand off to Mark to start the interview, and then we'll come back and close up the program at the end.
And now we turn to the interview with Tom Finan, Senior Cybersecurity Strategist and Counsel with the Department of Homeland Security's National Protection and Programs Division. And in particular, Tom has a lead for a lot of DHS's cybersecurity insurance initiative. So we're going to spend a few minutes talking about that and getting his perspective on what the department has done and what the department will be doing going forward with respect to cybersecurity. So Tom, to get started, I think in general, folks understand why a robust cybersecurity insurance market would be a good thing, but there are different kinds of cyber insurance, and so maybe you could spend a couple of minutes just talking through the differences, for example, between data breach insurance, which is at this point perhaps a more robust set of initiatives and policies, and sort of more comprehensive broader cybersecurity coverage and risk insurance, which is perhaps more nascent?
Well, thanks, Mark, and thanks for that question. And yes, you're exactly right. There is a very robust market now for what's essentially third-party cybersecurity insurance, which does cover the costs associated with the data breach. So things like privacy and network security claims, some regulatory fines, and attorney's fees are typically what falls into that category. And insurance in this area has been around for, I would say, for well over 10 years. Underwriters have a pretty good sense of how big and bad a data breach can get, and they have a pretty good sense of the kinds of claims that they're likely to cause. There's also an element of the first-party market that's also doing relatively well, and increasingly so, I would say, in the last 2 or 3 years, and that's cover for crisis management costs. So things like notification costs to impacted parties, sometimes crisis management teams, credit monitoring for impacted parties, and also the forensics work that is underway very often right after a data breach, so a company understands what kinds of exactly how a breach happened and what they need to do to fix it. That's been booming, and I think recent data breaches in the news certainly have, garnered a great deal of interest in this market. And so I think we're now up to approximately 70 insurance companies that are offering these kinds of coverage. DHS's interest in the market is a little bit different. We're certainly encouraging of any market-based incentive to encourage cybersecurity and wiser cybersecurity investments. But the particular area of the first-party market of great interest to us really has to do with cyber-related critical infrastructure loss. So any sort of cyber attack on an industrial control system, SCADA or otherwise, that will result in physical damage, which is really sort of the mission space of DHS, that resilience mission, in sort of addressing the cyber and physical aspects of risk. This is a nascent market. It's very hard to price this kind of coverage because, frankly, there's just not enough actuarial data for underwriters to do this in a confident way. However, we've held a number of public workshops over the last few years and really have teased out a lot of commentary from the insurance industry on the topic of risk culture. And in the last 6 months or so, a number of carriers, both in the UK and now in the US, are starting to offer, I would say, the first generation of coverage in this area.
Okay, great. Well thanks. And I think we're going to dig in a little bit more into those workshops and what you all have been doing and who the stakeholders are and what some of your preliminary conclusions are going to be as we go forward. And obviously, it makes sense that this is something DHS and particularly MPPD would be interested in given its critical infrastructure mission. So thanks for that. You mentioned those workshops. So, and I understand over the last year or so, there have been four, and a report was recently issued over the summer concluding the last workshop. So maybe you could take us through what the steps have been with those workshops, who's been at the table, what issues they've covered. For example, you mentioned how hard it is to price these programs. And frankly, I think the big question in everyone's mind is with a data breach, you can measure what you've lost and perhaps put steps in and insurance can cover it. But how do you measure the loss to critical infrastructure? And so I suspect that's something you've been wrestling with in these workshops.
That's a great question. And, you know, to be honest, cybersecurity insurance does not necessarily seem like the most likely candidate for a strategic area for DHS to move into. But as you said, we do have a broad risk management mission, and it's about meeting the customer on its own terms. And what we're discovering through some conversations with our critical infrastructure and other partners is that they were very focused on risk mitigation, but they were coming to the realization about 2.5 years ago that they really needed to start looking at risk transfer options. And so they were able to find the kinds of coverage that I described previously for data breach, but were really not finding that physical coverage where there was a cyber nexus. So we decided to figure out what the problem was, and we tried to invite as many stakeholders from different backgrounds as possible. So we certainly invited the insurance industry, but we also invited chief risk officers and experts in enterprise risk management, critical infrastructure owners themselves, representatives from the academic community, and probably one of the most important stakeholder groups, CISOs and other cybersecurity professionals. And we wanted to explore with them, you know, what were the main obstacles to the market and what could be done to overcome them. And that was where the conversation started in September of 2012, and it culminated in our most recent workshop this past April at the White House. In short, the main obstacles to expanding this area of first-party coverage is that, as I mentioned, there's just not enough actuarial data. And so they're forced to look at sort of the risk culture of an organization. And we specifically focus conversation not only at our first meeting but at our second one on the elements of an effective cyber risk culture, because a lot of the underwriters were telling us that they look to those elements to sort of gut check whether or not a company had a pretty good handle on its cyber risk or was in a better posture perhaps than its peers. So we looked at the roles of executive leadership, you know, what were they demanding and doing themselves to promote a culture of cybersecurity within their organizations. We certainly looked at the role of education and awareness. What measures did a company have in place, and to what extent were they educating the workforce at all levels about their roles and responsibilities vis-a-vis cybersecurity? We also had the question of what's the role of technology? You know, how are they leveraging the investments that they're already making? Which ones are they missing? And then the perennial favorite, information sharing. But we really tried to focus on what kinds of information and in what formats need to be shared with whom to drive a wiser risk management strategy against cyber risk. And so that has led to a series of conversations that have continued and culminated in some of the action areas where the insurance industry especially feels that some progress in the years ahead may be had.
Great. So building on that, and in particular perhaps building on that last point, which is sort of information sharing, and I know your most recent report talked about that and the possible creation of a data repository where maybe some of this actuarial data could be held and mined, for lack of a better word, so the insurance market can begin to build. Maybe you can spend a few minutes talking about some of the key conclusions before we get to next steps, but you've had these series of workshops. It's now been 2 years. Where are the stakeholders in this process?
It's a great question, and I think we really sort of surfaced three main conclusions. And the first one was that the case for investing against cyber risk for many companies, not all, but for many of them, still has not been made. And one of the points that was made time and time again by many of our stakeholders was that cyber risk still has not been reduced to terms that non-technical business leaders can readily understand, namely the financial costs of cyber events and the potential damages to reputation for failing to mitigate them effectively. So I would say practically all of the attendees at our events have been big proponents of enterprise risk management, ERM, and they really see that as a sign that if a company has a robust ERM program that incorporates cyber risk, then that's a good sign that this is a safer insurance bet than perhaps another company. The troubling trend, unfortunately, is that for many companies that purport to have ERM programs, they do exclude cyber risk from that ERM family, which means essentially that they're not running an ERM program. So a lot of our focus was on how do we incorporate cyber risk into ERM, and how do you make it, put it into those financial and reputational harm terms so it can be treated like any other risk and assessed holistically against other business risks. Another theme that arose was that there's really a need to understand the costs and benefits of different investments against cyber risk. There's really a hard time that companies are facing to determine whether or not they should be making an investment in a particular technology or training or an internal messaging campaign. And so they were hoping that there'd be a methodology developed perhaps by the academic community, perhaps in partnership with government, to figure out, you know, where do you get the most bang for the buck? And that's an area that's really crying out for attention. And the third area, frankly, was sort of a level setting of what we can realistically expect from the insurance industry. I think there was some concern that companies would be eager to purchase cybersecurity insurance and that the insurance policy would be the sum total of their risk management program. And they really emphasized very, very forcefully that they are hoping that companies will engage with them and CISOs and cybersecurity professionals over time will engage with them to really tease out what kind of cyber risk can be truly mitigated, what's practical to mitigate, and what really is the residual cyber risk that must be transferred through insurance. And that's an ongoing dialogue that needs to happen, and it's happening today.
Okay. Great, thanks. I think, and before we get to that ongoing dialogue, and in particular, I ask you to look into your crystal ball as to what's next for the cybersecurity insurance portfolio for DHS and perhaps the market more broadly. You've been doing this for 2 years. You mentioned earlier that in recent months in particular, there's been quite a bit of press surrounding high-profile data breaches affecting millions of customers, costing millions of dollars. From your perspective, how has the market changed since this initiative began? Are we actually now in a better place where we can start taking concrete next steps towards making this nascent market more robust?
I think we are in a better place. I think it's helped, certainly, that we've had these workshops and we've been focusing attention on it. But I think the market naturally is responding to the consumer as well. And, you know, a lot of policies were written early on, over 10 years ago, tied to a risk consultancy model and then the risk transfer piece coming in. And over time, there's natural competition in the insurance market. And that risk consultancy model sort of fell away. And so what was happening was, maybe 10 or 20 underwriting questions being directed and then a policy typically being written. I think with the recent events affecting especially the retail sector, there's a growing awareness among insurance companies that they really do need to find those companies and understand from the companies that want insurance what their risk management strategy is. They want to provide a portion of a comprehensive risk management portfolio, but they can't basically hold the bag for the full amount of risk. So I think you're starting to see the pendulum swing back, and you're starting to see underwriters ask deeper questions, offer things like vulnerability assessments, looking to connect clients with potential cybersecurity solution providers who can be on site or provide consulting services. They've been around, but they haven't been used necessarily. But I think now the customer is more educated, and they see the value in complementing not only the CISOs that they already have on staff and other cybersecurity professionals, but actually having that outside objective view to partner with their on-site capabilities. And I think that's something that's going to continue. I think as the risk continues to evolve rapidly, there'll be a need for new players in the market that can provide up-to-the-minute information about evolving cyber incidents and the risk controls that companies are going to need. So I think you're going to see much more of an interactive model where insurance is not just something that's renewed once a year, but it's a conversation with the underwriter that goes on very regularly, and it brings in other parties such as cybersecurity solutions providers.
Great. That's actually a question I was going to ask, so I'm glad you addressed it, because I was interested and am interested to the extent you've seen these partnerships developing, because while there may be some in-house expertise for these insurance companies and their underwriting departments, this is, again, not something they've done traditionally. And so I think, glad to hear that there's a willingness on their part to reach out to cybersecurity professionals who do this for a living and bring them in to the underwriting process. So you've seen that.
We have, and it's interesting. I've seen it even in the last year in a very pronounced way. In November of last year, we hosted a number of healthcare organizations, specifically CISOs from those organizations, to talk to us about how they managed a cyber incident that they had actually experienced and how cybersecurity insurance played as part of their process. And so they took us through, I think, very detailed examples of what happened. But I think by and large, they were pretty uncertain about cybersecurity insurance. And it really boiled down to the fact that they work in companies that obviously, like every company, has a limited amount of risk management dollars. And frankly, they want all those dollars for risk mitigation. And a risk transfer solution is something that competes with that. And frankly, they were unsure as to whether or not a cybersecurity insurance policy would actually pay out. I think after some of the events of the last year, that mindset is changing. And you're seeing CISOs being much more open to saying to their boards, look, we're very good and we can manage a lot of this risk, but we can't do it all because the risk is so tremendous. And we really need to be honest with you about that and what our capabilities are. That helps them justify their programs, and it also helps them be honest and help their company be better prepared. So I think you're starting to see insurance companies that are offering a risk mitigation complement to the on-site staff. They're sort of picking up on that, and you're starting to see more willingness. I don't want to let the insurance companies off the hook either. I think that they were interested in talking to the CISO, but maybe only once or twice a year for an hour, and it was a quick conversation and not a relationship. But I think the ground has been set for building relationships between the CISO and the insurance community now, and I think you're going to see more of that.
Okay. So turning towards next steps and following up on what we may see more of, what we may see less of going forward, what's next for DHS? And I mean that both potentially internally to DHS with its interagency partners, and then in particular DHS reaching out to the critical infrastructure community. And I'd be interested to hear whether there are any particular sectors of that community that you think are more prone to take more advanced steps at the moment, whether there are others, perhaps without naming names, that are being a little bit more reluctant to come along. But, you know, you've done these workshops. What's next for you and the department over the next several months into next year?
Sure. There were three main solution areas that the insurance industry identified as, if we could make progress in any one of them, it's not that any one of them would be a silver bullet, but it would certainly help advance the market. And as you mentioned previously, the idea of a cyber incident data repository where CISOs and others could, on an anonymized basis, contribute cyber incident data information was one that they were particularly interested in because of that lack of actuarial data. They certainly like assessing a company's risk culture, but their DNA is really the data. And so we went into some deep discussion in April, and it came out in our readout report this past July, about the kinds of data points that would be particularly helpful from an underwriting perspective, and a lot of discussion about how do you actually incentivize CISOs and others to contribute information? How do you create a safe space where they feel that they can do that? Tied very closely to that is the analysis that you actually put onto that data. So the creation of a cyber incident consequence analytics. How do you help the insurance industry and frankly all cyber risk management professionals understand what the first, second, and third order effects are likely to be from a cyber attack against critical infrastructure? It's not that the insurance industry is going to be able to underwrite catastrophe, but there's a wide range of run-of-the-mill cyber incidents and then the point where you actually get to that. And so our challenge is really helping find that space where the insurance industry can offer more coverage than it does today, where it feels that a series of risk controls actually make moving into that coverage area worthwhile. The third area where we talked a lot about was enterprise risk management, specifically that cultural challenge of bringing cyber risk into the ERM fold, and then how do you direct that conversation to the mid-size and small companies that are very often the vendors of the larger companies that have robust ERM programs, and how do you, make it part of their business DNA to treat cyber risk as they would any other risk? So we've been taking a lot of feedback from the report that came out in July. It's been received, I think, very positively. People have lots of ideas and lots of reactions. The sense I'm getting is that the repository idea is getting the most traction, which makes sense because it's a foundational policy area to at least discuss the concept. And we've been reaching out across the federal interagency. We've been talking a lot to the Treasury Department, certainly Commerce and NIST in particular, given their work on the cybersecurity framework. And as we gather information and ideas from the public and from the stakeholders that have engaged us, we're hoping to plan out perhaps steps for a future working group, drilling down on the cyber incident data repository idea and how we bring those analytics about. There are a lot of sectors that are waking up to the existence of cybersecurity insurance. Some of them were not aware that it was out there. I think what I've been hearing from a lot of the folks in the insurance industry is that the energy sector is an early mover in this space, particularly the oil, natural gas subsector, because they have industrial control systems that they're very concerned about. The UK market, frankly, has been a little bit ahead of the US market in terms of providing coverage for this, but I think the US market is not far behind. And I think you're naturally going to see some of these life support sectors showing interest in insurance. So beyond energy, I think you're going to start to see water. I think you're going to start to see transportation customers potentially interested. Any utilities, frankly, are starting to take a deeper look than they have in the past at what a comprehensive cyber risk management program needs to look like. And as more information comes out about cybersecurity insurance, they're able to, I think, engage with that community more intelligently and with more information than they have in the past.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. It's exciting to hear that DHS and the government more broadly is facilitating this and that we seem to be making progress. I'll give you a chance to, as a wrap-up, to, I think, plug your reports. I think they can be found online because DHS and MPPD in particular has a page dedicated to cybersecurity insurance issues. And so perhaps for the benefit of our audience, you could give them that information so they'll both know where to find those reports and know where to find you to the extent they're interested in further discussions, because I know from our past discussions that you're open to all stakeholders and open to engaging in discussions and conversations with a wide range of folks on this issue.
Certainly, and I'd welcome that sincerely. You can find the four readout reports from our events on the DHS Cybersecurity Insurance webpage. If you use the search engine of your choice and look up DHS and cybersecurity insurance, it's usually the first or second entry. And I really do welcome feedback from the public, any ideas about how we could develop these ideas further. Anything that we're missing that folks think is important is really stuff that we want to hear about. And they should feel free to reach me at my work email address. It's tom.finan, F as in Frank, I, N as in Nancy, A, N as in Nancy, at dhs.gov. And I promise I will get back to you. I welcome the feedback that we've had so far, and any more that can come our way will help us think through our agendas into the future.
Great. And following up just a bit on the self-promotion angle, is there anything else either on your agenda in terms of workshops, speaking events, or appearances, or on the MPPD agenda more broadly that you'd like folks to know about?
Sure. I'm actually speaking next week at the Advising Conference in New York. I'm doing the afternoon keynote where I'll be talking a lot about a lot of the topics that we covered here today, with a bit of a big data analytics bent, which is a little bit different. And I would just continue to look at our website for any future announcements about what we're doing. Our workshops to date have been publicly announced, and they will continue to be. So I'll be sure to push them out so there's maximum distribution and awareness.
Great. Well, Tom, thanks very much. Very much enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mark Frey, Stephanie Roy, Michael Vadas, Tom Finan. Before we sign off, we do want to give everyone an opportunity to plug upcoming speaking engagements. If there is anything on your calendar, let me know. I am actually in Minneapolis for a couple of speeches tomorrow, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, and then heading back to Washington. So until I head off to Dublin, which will be next week, I just have those. We wanted to make sure everybody remembered that the Cyber Law podcast is open to feedback. If you've got questions, suggestions for interview candidates or topics, just send them to cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com. And if you want to leave a message by phone, we will play the most entertainingly abusive messages. Contact us at 1-202-862-5785. This has been episode 39 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. We hope you'll join us next week when we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.